Fanning, weekends on 2FM.
Anyway, I want to talk to somebody now who's got a very interesting story to tell. Photographer Carl McNaughton. McNaughton, I know he goes by both. He's from Antrim, and he's the first and only ever photographer to date from Ireland to be awarded a Pulitzer Prize. It was his images of Rohingya refugees fleeing genocide in Myanmar, which earned him the prestigious award in 2018 whilst working for the Reuters news agency. The award also marked a turning point in his life, such that now, at the age of 42, he lives in the remote glens of Antrim alone in a small cottage, and up until very recently he hadn't even owned a camera. And he joins me now for the glens of Antrim. Where is he? Is he on extension or external one? Carl, how you doing? Are you all right?
Yes, I'm well, thank you.
Good morning. So, Carl, I did say you live alone. That is not true. Do you have a dog?
I do have a dog, yeah, Murphy.
Murphy the dog. Well, then, yeah. Once you have a dog, you're not alone, for crying out loud. So I'll change that next time. Now, look, by the way, that's quite an achievement. The first and only Irish photographer to have won a Pulitzer Prize in New York. Tell me about that assignment that you won the prize for. You were in Bangladesh, right?
Yeah, I was in Bangladesh covering the arrival of the Rohingya people who were fleeing the military and persecution in Myanmar. So I was there photographing them as they arrived at the refugee camps.
And at the time of the Pulitzer Award, where had you been living?
I was living in Delhi. I was Reuters chief photographer in India. So this story was happening just basically next door to me. So it was something I felt very strongly that I wanted to go and cover and see for myself.
And how did you get from there where you are now, which is back to sort of zero in some ways, how did you get from there to actually become this person for Reuters?
Well, it was a pretty traditional sort of career path, I suppose. I started in local newspapers and worked my way up, gradually working for bigger and bigger news agencies via the London, the Daily Telegraph, and the Press Association in London. And then eventually this job came up in India, and I was asked if I'd be interested because I was at that stage a Reuters photographer in Ireland, covering Ireland. But this opportunity came up, and they wanted me to go and make my mark over there.
And was it that your base in Asia was a great place to be? You know, like, we want you to go to Japan, Nepal, Bhutan, whatever, and where you were, it was perfect.
Yeah, it's a great location. It's a great hub to head to other areas, surrounding countries. So, yeah, it was there was never a dull moment, really, and it was presented a challenge for me, which I really wanted at the time. Little did I know how much of a challenge it was going to become, but it was a perfect place to work.
Right, a perfect place to work. But you had to travel to New York to accept the award, and you encountered problems returning to India after travelling to accept it, and that was New York. What was all that about?
Right, well, basically, to cut a long story short, I had worked in Kashmir, which is a region of India that is in a lot of political and civil unrest. And basically, the Indian government didn't like that I was highlighting this to the world, basically. And so on my return from collecting the Pulitzer, I was stopped at the airport and basically put straight back on the plane that I had arrived in, straight back to Toronto.
And you were looking out from where you were. You see your driver in his car waiting for you. You text him, whatever, and say, yeah, I'll be out in a minute, or whatever it was. Why did the authorities in India, why exactly did they refuse your re-entry into India, where your home was and all your stuff was?
Yeah, no, basically because of the Kashmir situation, and the Indian government would like very much if people didn't know anything about it. And I was just, I was highlighting it on a scale that hadn't been done in a while. So they were quite smart about it. They actually didn't kick me out of the country. They just stopped me getting back into the country. So so job done for them.
Job done for them, and you were unable to go back to India. You did get one option. You know, Reuters said, okay, you can go to Manila, but you didn't. You went back to Antrim.
Yeah, I was given the option to go to Manila, which was an interesting job at the time, but and it's a very interesting story with Duterte's government, etc. But It was what happened at the time was then my father got ill. My mum was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. All of these perfect. It was a perfect storm, really. And what happened then was I wasn't under control of what was happening anymore, because we were actually still at this stage. We didn't know why they wouldn't let me in to India, and we were trying to get some clarity in the situation. So the hope was that I would still be going back to India and taking up my role again. But that transpired after months and months and through government back channels, just exactly what the situation was. So basically I said, to hell with this. I was fed up with it. I was living out of a suitcase for months. Things were very unsure. I decided I would take control of the situation, go home and look after my family. I knew that's where I really needed to be. And so that's what I did, and I'm still here.
Well, then, in terms of the story of the Rohingya, I mean, fleeing Myanmar or Burma, as it was for a long time, it's a Muslim community who are fleeing persecution from a mainly Buddhist country. And at least, you know, there's 1 month figures of 9,000 dying between August and September in 17, and then a massive exodus of 1 million into Bangladesh. Like, we're talking about documenting a humanitarian crisis, mass killings, etc. So you are not really a photographer, are you? You're a photojournalist.
Yeah, well... Yeah, without a doubt, I am a journalist who takes photographs.
Yeah.
So So whenever you go there, like, I research the story, I get the details just the same as any other, you know, let's say a reporter would do. So yeah, I'm not just there to take photographs. I'm there to understand the story and put it across in such a way that everybody else can understand it as well.
But what about your early experience then? Now, I know I'm jumping all over the place, but back in Northern Ireland, working during the Troubles, did it in any way prepare you for the volatile situation that you found yourself in working later? I mean, for instance, one of your first solo assignments, the aftermath of OMA.
Yeah, well, these things did. I'd served my time, if you want to put it that way. I was born in the north here in Ireland, and, you know, it... Day to day, you're dealing with civil unrest, and it becomes this, you know, crazy normality that isn't normal. And so it just gives you a slight edge and an understanding whenever you move off to other places, because I was effectively living in a war zone, albeit at the tail end of the troubles. But, you know, I was still having to do things like change what name I used in particular areas I went to take pictures in, you know, things that aren't just normal everyday things. So I definitely served my time before I went on to any other assignments in maybe conflict zones or humanitarian disasters.
You know, I mean, at OMA or after the OMA bombing, you took a simple black and white picture of a young boy at one of the funerals wiping away a tear. When that was used as much as it was used as a wraparound of the paper, what does it make you, and is there anything about it that says this is the path I've chosen, I'm damn like glad that I have chosen this, or do you just think this is terrible stuff? Do you have any time to praise yourself for doing some of the work you do?
That's a difficult one, because if you praising yourself for documenting something that is maybe, you know, harrowing or as brutal as the OMA bomb or the Rohingya, you know, that can mess with your head a little bit, because it's not something you should really be patting yourself on the back for. But, and even saying winning the Pulitzer Prize doesn't really sit that well with me. I would like to say I was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for the work I did, but it's not really, I don't look at it as a competition. Mm. I just look at it as, an award for doing something.
Well,
I presume
it would be fair to say that others do. Others in your profession do. You've seen people in situations where what they're going for is the prize.
Oh, of course, of course. Like any situation, you know, any career, lots of people motivate it in different ways, you know. But that's not how I'm motivated. Now, at the beginning of my career, of course, I was in it for the excitement as much as anything else. And I loved winning awards and things. It massaged my ego very well as a young man. But as you grow older and mature a little bit, then the reasons for doing what I do have changed somewhat.
Do you know when I don't mean to, you know, doo-doo all over a current generation, but you know, if anybody wants to find out anything these days, they go to a thing called Google. I mean, years ago, you might have to go to libraries or Encyclopedia Britannica and check up for weeks and weeks and do a lot of research, etc. The stuff that you did in the 90s, like, you know, still using maybe film cameras right up to the end of the 90s and working in a dark room and all that kind of thing, has that held you in good stead, do you think, now?
It didn't do any harm. It gave me an understanding of the chemistry or the behind photography and how it actually works. It gave me a good foundation, but I don't, hark back to the halcyon days of film or anything like that. I'm very much into the digital now, and it's the one thing I would say is what held me to best in my career was probably the mentor I had at the very beginning of my career. That's what helped form me as a photographer. So the picture editor of the Irish News at that time was very influential in my career, and still is somewhat.
Do you know, it's my good friend Rosie who put me on to you and told me about your photos, and I had a look. And I don't know if this would be praise or not praise, or if you'd want me to explain it, because I don't think I can explain it. But here it goes. I think you've got a kind of a style. There's a certain style about what you have in terms of your photos. Well, the ones I've seen. Is that fair? Or please don't ask me to explain that, because I don't know if I could.
Yes, that's fair. And it's something, actually, I will allow myself to be very pleased with that, because it... Yeah, I have developed a style over the years, and I can see it myself.
Yeah.
It's a very simple style. It's, you know, but yeah, I would say I have a style as well. I think you could pick my pictures out from other people's.
Yeah, exactly. You went to work internationally. Was some part of you attracted to the adrenaline of potentially being in dangerous situations and places? You often see that in movies. You know, people just have this sort of thing for it. Like, in what particular situation did you feel most vulnerable or feel that you were in most danger?
Right. Well, yeah, of course you're attracted to the adrenaline, the rush you get. I'm not some sort of war junkie. I'm not a conflict. Well, I don't cover war zones, really. I've been in them, but I don't do it day to day. But yeah, there's been many times things have happened. There's been close calls, you know, but one that does stick out in my mind was actually in India. And when people say I was running for my life, I actually was running for my life at that stage. I was being chased by thousands of followers of basically a cult leader who had just been found guilty of rape among other things. And they kicked off and ransacked the place. They came running after me and a few other journalists. If they had got me, like, I was dead. That was a hairy situation. Then live, you know, there was live rounds fired and 20 plus people died within the space of a few minutes. So yeah, there are hairy situations. I don't go looking for them, but what I would say is that I have, through my career, because I've been working in riots and conflicts and things, I would have a sort of a sixth sense that I would try and, you know, I would have a rough idea of how these things usually pan out, because a riot or situations, they usually follow the same pattern. And once you can guess, you can preempt what is going to happen a lot of the time. So that is... stood me in good stead.
Yeah, but no matter how much preparation you do, you know, there's nothing, the cold face, once you're there on the ground, things change every 5 seconds, I suppose. I mean, the whole idea of, you know, of being there and getting there, you did purposely seek out the stories that you think should be told, and you campaigned hard to go to Bangladesh to shoot pictures of the Rohingya, didn't you?
Yeah, I gave my boss at the time... a bit of a headache. I was on to him constantly saying, I really want to go on this story. I think I should be covering it. But he was wanting, because I was looking after day-to-day in India, he really needed me to stay in India. But eventually, after enough harassing, he let me go. So, thanks to him for that. But,
Well, then, how do you go about photographing people who are so vulnerable, with no power or agency over their lives, without feeling that you are intruding or exploiting their situation?
Well, that comes down to your own ethics, why you're doing it. And I'm very much comfortable with, you know, the morals and the ethics to how I shoot things and approach work. You have to be very, very sensitive of how other people feel. You also have to remember why you're there. I'm there for to show the rest of the world what is going to happen is or what is happening, and giving these people a voice. So you have to, you know, it's not a black and white situation. You take each person, you treat them as an individual, and you act accordingly towards that individual and whatever the circumstances require.
Well, at the moment, as I say, you're not exactly living in self-isolation, but you are as near enough to off-grid as anybody I know. You do have Murphy, but do you think the fact that you've retreated from that life that we've talked about and live so radically different now is a result of pressures you were experiencing for so many years in the job, whether conscious or subconscious?
Oh, without a doubt. It's been, you know, I've done a lot of reflecting over the past 2 or 3 years now, and basically, because I didn't choose to stop, you know, it was an enforced thing, me stopping doing what I was doing.
Yeah.
I describe it as like I stepped off the roller coaster, and whenever you're you have all this time inside your own head, you start reflecting and thinking, and I had to deal with a lot of issues because they came bubbling to the surface, as they often do whenever you stop to take a break. And so it's actually been quite good for me. It was hard at the beginning, you know, especially with family and stuff, but
yeah,
or coming from, you know, what should be the pinnacle of your career to all of a sudden living in the side of a mountain in a cottage with a dog, you know, it's a bit of a transformation, although it's one I chose myself. I even find myself reminding myself that I chose to be here. It's not, you know, I chose to be in this cottage and living how I am now, and I think I'm the better person for it.
Okay, but when you are in tough parts of the world, do you think in some ways that, you know, there is a sort of a mantra, if you like, or something you live by? Like, if you write words or if you take pictures, at the end of the day, they're a means to an end. The story is everything.
Yeah, definitely. As I say, there's, you know, why I choose out these particular stories. I could have went down the route of fashion. I could have went down the route of sports. I've covered both those things. But, you know, I feel that my skills are best suited to telling these stories. Not everybody is. So I think whenever you've got a particular set of skills, without trying to quote Liam Neeson, you have to use them. So I was given the ability to maybe engage with people and show their emotions and feelings through pictures. So that's what I do.
Okay, well, that engagement, you're now 42, a very young man, so you're not done, are you?
No, I'm not done. I'm definitely feeling the urge to... there's people close to me wouldn't like to hear this, but there's a lot of stories I see in the news that I would very much like to be in the middle of again. So I've just in the past few weeks I've bought myself cameras again, and I'm cautiously stepping back onto the roller coaster again. I'll have to be a little bit more choosy about what I shoot, but there's stories out there that I feel very strongly about. Even like, to be honest, one of the most important stories of our time, I think, is happening right now in Ireland. And I think direct provision is something that I would like to highlight. I think this is like our modern day Magdalene Laundries, if I can say that, you know, and it's something that really needs to be talked about.
Yeah, and also, of course, like, there's always been misinformation and propaganda and all that kind of stuff, but it would be good to be re-educating people, not just in secondary schools and not just in primary schools, but in universities and everything else, about how we consume our media and just how to do it as well, because social media is changing things very quickly and very fast and making people believe things they shouldn't necessarily believe. And I'm leading up to something here now, because I want you to tell me about something that happened in Dublin. I think it was in Dublin, was it? Was it in the Pro Cathedral or something like that? You went to... right, okay, I've got it, he's got it, okay, fair enough. I'm right. No, St. Patrick's Cathedral, right? St. Patrick's Cathedral. And you went to a pro-abortion protest because you, Reuters had asked you to go, is that it?
Yeah, well, I shouldn't. It's a very, very serious.
It is, of course.
You know, excuse me for laughing, but I love the way that you sort of segued into that. But anyway, without my knowledge, that was very good. But yeah, so we had been told. I'm sure you're aware of FEMEN, the
campaign for women's rights, etc. Yeah,
that's right. So they've done. They've taken part in some more and more outrageous stunts around the world to highlight women's issues, which is fine. But on this particular occasion, we were contacted and told that there was something going to happen in the St. Patrick's Cathedral and to turn up at this particular time if we wanted to see it. So I turned up, and little did I know that I was the only person there. So I walked into the cathedral with my cameras, and, you know, there's lots of tourists and things knocking about. And there was this... I was told to look for a lady, so I saw this lady sitting on a pew, and for some reason I decided I would sit down behind her, like I was in the Bourne Identity or something, and ask what she was doing there. And she had a Eastern European accent and red lipstick and a trench coat. It was all very you know, Bourne supremacy type. So anyway, she got up and said, "Follow me." So I followed her up towards the altar, and yeah, she took off her coat, and she was naked underneath, and she had some stuff scrawled or painted onto her body, and she had awful, let's say, and she proceeded to go up and stand on the altar. Meanwhile, I'm looking around thinking, if anybody sees us, we're in big trouble here. Mm-hmm. You know, the guards are going to arrest us or something. So I'm trying my best to get this picture taken as quick as I can. But then she hops up onto the altar and grabs a crucifix, and she stands with it. So I shot off some frames, still just waiting to hear somebody scream at what they were seeing or witnessing. And then I kind of realized that, you know, the longer I stood there, the more she wasn't scared. She was, you know, she was doing what she believed in. So it was just going to get more and more outrageous because, you know, as long as I was there, she was going to be there. So I stopped taking photos and walked out. She put her coat on, walked out as well. Not one person saw us in the middle of St. Patrick's Cathedral. I could not believe it. I said... I got her details when we went outside, and she disappeared off into the night, and I never saw her again.
And not only that, the photograph didn't get printed, and it might have done if there was more than just you. So let's take a look at this just for one last bit here, which is she had got in touch with you, or she had got in touch with Reuters, whatever, because Reuters is so big. And if you had put those pictures everywhere, everybody would have seen them. So you understand her point of view, do you? That she was using you, if you like, but in being used, you didn't want to carry it out.
Yeah, well, basically, no, I completely understand what she was doing. Fair play to her. That's exactly how you work situations.
And how you get attention, yeah,
which is grand. But the decision was made that we were being taken advantage of too often by this particular group, and that on this occasion we just weren't going to put the pictures out. Not because it was too shocking. They were shocking. But because we weren't going to become a puppet for anybody, really. So I stand by that decision. It wasn't my decision, but I stand by the decision that was made.
All right. Well, listen, we are going to hear more from you soon, I'd say, at some stage. All right, because you are going back into the big wide world, as opposed to being, as I put it earlier, which is probably a bit unfair, off grid. What was I going to say? You're going to be the subject of a documentary, I've just been told, as well. So there's lots happening, basically, with Carl. By the way, is it McNaughton or McNaughton?
It depends wherever you're from.
Ah, right. I'll stick with McNaughton. We're going to be talking about how to pronounce and how to talk Irish later on. So, yeah, I'll stick with McNaughton, okay? So, listen, Carl, thanks a million for talking to us. Where can people see your work, by the way, the one that I've been talking about? You can just go online, yeah?
Yeah, well, it just so happens that, yes, I have a website. And if you go on to Google me, Cahill-McNaughton.com, there's a website, and I've got merchandise and stuff on that. So go and have a wee look. That would be awesome.
Indeed. Listen, good man, Carl, and congratulations, and thank you very much indeed for talking to us on the programme today, and good luck with the world. Thanks.
Cheers.
Dave Fanning, weekends on 2FM.